Hello, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I'm your host, Paul David, co-founder and CEO of Literal Humans. I'm joined today by Net Wally, co-founder and CEO of Organize. And today we're going to talk about tech worker empowerment. Welcome to the pod, Net.
Thank you for having me. Very excited to be here.
Yeah. First of all, we wanted to just kind of introduce you and share a bit about what Organize does. Organize is a startup that empowers workers to shape the future of work in the UK and the US. And before founding Organize, Net worked for grassroots organizations like 38 Degrees and Avaaz and led digital strategies at Save the Children. Net was recently named one of the top 100 women in social enterprise 2024. Congratulations. That's very exciting.
Thank you.
Was there a big award ceremony? Like what did all that entail?
There was, but I'm now based in the US, so I didn't go to it.
Oh, gosh. Okay. So it was a UK-based award, I guess? Or
it's a UK award, yeah.
Okay. Very cool. Well, congratulations on that. I'm sure it's very, very well deserved. Well, wanted to kind of like set the scene for our audience so they kind of understand this idea of tech that drives worker empowerment, because it's something that we're very interested in. We specialize in working with tech for good companies. So we know that historically trade unions have kind of been the main way that workers, you know, have affected change. And there's been a lot in the air about the relevance today of unions. And some say that like in the digital age, you know, especially with AI able to you know, quote unquote, replace a lot of jobs, that unions are decreasingly relevant. And alternative opinions from like the BBC, for example, who claim that unions are entering a golden age. So be curious, like you're doing that work on the ground, which opinion do you think is closer to the truth there?
So I'm definitely in the camp. I think we're in a golden age. I'm probably a bit biased, but I think if you think back to the industrial revolutions we've lived through in the past, at every point where there's been worker power, that's been the rebalance as we live through this big revolution. So I think like AI for me, I see as like the fourth industrial revolution. And having a good worker power to balance out how we experience that. Like it was unions basically that won us the weekend. And before that, we were working 6-7 days a week. So if we think through what could AI look like for workers in the future, I think, you know, with unions and workers taking collective action, we can get to a place where workers are doing 3 or 4 days a week. And that's a really exciting future.
That's really cool. So yeah, I mean, you look at some of the stats, like we saw in 2022, the number of members in the UK rose for the fourth consecutive year for unions. So that's very exciting. But obviously, like different context in the US, which has disproportionately more non-unionized workers. So I'd be curious to hear your understanding of like the differences between those landscapes and how much the overarching political and legal framework sort of influences them.
Totally. So for context, obviously Organize is very big in the UK. That's where we started, as you can probably tell by my accent. And we've just started growing organically in the US. We have about 2 million members in the UK and about 50,000 in the US for context. And the differences we really see is like the workers use the technology that we have in the same way. But the difference is historically, I think unions in the US have had much harder rules to fight through. So particularly in southern states, the right to work states, it's really, really, really hard to form a formal union. But actually workers are taking collective action outside the kind of formal structures. And that's one thing that Organize facilitates. So you don't need to have a formal union to get yourself heard at work. You know, obviously the dream is everyone's in those unions, but actually there's lots of ways you can build power and organize collectively without needing a union formally. And that's one of the exciting things we're seeing in the US in particular, how our members are using the platform.
Curious to hear, you know, sort of what you think about, you mentioned the golden era, and obviously there was a lot of hay made of like, you know, what happened with the SAG-AFTRA, you know, negotiations and Hollywood essentially coming to a stop. But like what are other sort of proof points that you have that, hey, we're entering a golden age, and especially with, you know, the way that tech is putting pressure, I think, on jobs and contract negotiations and things like that. You know, just curious what the other proof points are in your book.
Yeah, so I think one of the most inspiring campaigns is the Starbucks workers. So this is, you know, at Starbucks, across the US, there's loads of pockets of workers who are being inspired by seeing other people form unions and then copying that model and bringing it to their own store. And so I think that's something that's really tech enabled. Like that used to kind of live, it would happen, but you wouldn't hear about it, or you'd hear about it months later, whereas that's happening in real time. And I think if you look at how those workers, they're particularly young workers, are using things like TikTok to kind of inspire and show in real time what's happening in these negotiations when they're like doing like marches on the boss, those sort of traditional union tactics, but using them in a digital way to spread the word. I think that's kind of the thing that's driving that golden era. It's like this kind of flywheel of people taking action.
Yeah, interesting.
Seeing others doing it themselves.
Interesting. So curious to hear a bit more about like the, we're a tech podcast. We work with tech for good companies, and specifically this intersection, you know, sort of between like technology and labor rights and advocacy. So like, what do you sort of see as the future of the work, the future of work generally from where you sit, particularly in light of like, you know, tech advancements that are causing these shifts in the labor market? I can speak from our perspective. Like, we're already seeing, you know, our designers went to a training on Thursday about Midjourney and how that's going to, you know, accelerate their efficiency and probably like decrease, frankly, the number of designers we're going to need to work with. We're already seeing this in the context with our writers and our content strategists who can, you know, put a lot of that work onto, you know, ChatGPT and things like that. You know, will this growing, shall we call it the gig economy, will it affect workers' ability to organize? And how can, you know, companies like yours kind of help workers in this day and age?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, a lot of that is kind of what led us to set up Organize. So I think historically, when you'd see workers organizing, it would be by region, like it's often done like locally, whereas actually we were seeing workers, they had multiple jobs. So yeah, you might have a main job, like particularly if you're under 30, you definitely have a side hustle, you know, whether that's selling stuff on Etsy or like, you know, doing like Upwork jobs. And then couple that with the fact that people move jobs much more than they used to. So the way our data is structured, so we're a social network for workers to talk and take collective action. And when we started, you could organize by workplace, industry, and sector. And now we're actually seeing people are much more fluid in how they identify at work. It's like many of these different things. So we've had to adapt how our structure works to allow people to kind of bring their whole identity, their whole working identity to the different groups in the platform. But I think that's the important thing, is like as these kind of jobs shift, giving people the ability to be flexible about how they organize and take collective action is the thing that unlocks that kind of power that rebalances how that wealth is distributed.
Mm. We see that, you know, one of the stats here is like 36% of workers say that ethical integration of AI is like their top concern. So that this is a stat that comes from Fast Company and some research out of Harvard. Curious, like what you're hearing on the ground, like are many workers anxious about AI? Are they chill about it? Are they, you know, are they sort of in between? Like what are you hearing on the ground?
Yeah, so I think this comes back to the point of like the data we give AI really changes what happens. And that's a big worry for workers. Like we see that time and time again on our platform. But the thing that's interesting is they're creating their own data to kind of advocate for the type of AI they need. So an example we had was a bunch of like train engineers where they got shifted to how they got allocated their jobs was switched to an AI that was basically deciding where they went. But the data it didn't have was how long, where they lived. So how long it would take them to drive to these different jobs.
Wow.
So the difference between a human doing that job and AI on the paper looked made total sense, but AI didn't have all the data it needed. So workers use our platform to basically aggregate the data around like where they lived and how much extra time it was taking them to do these jobs because of the algorithm, and then use that to drive a shift in how the algorithm was structured. So I think there's a real like need for the workers to be able to basically input to these algorithms that are deciding, you know, what AI looks like.
Yeah. So that's quite like a somewhat of a techno-optimist perspective. Like, would you consider like if we have worker input into how the AIs are developed and built and deployed, do you feel fairly optimistic that, you know, it'll lead to kind of a pro worker outcome, or how do you sort of land on that?
I think I'm a wild optimist. I think if you're a founder, you kind of have to be.
Right? Yeah, yes.
And I think brutally, like AI is coming, you know, whether we organize or we don't. So it's like, How do you organize to make that the optimal outcome for workers? And I think genuinely, like making sure that workers can feed in, because they're often the people making the decisions about whether or not to bring in AI aren't necessarily close to what's happening on the ground and won't have all the context. And so it's like the more we can give workers the tools to advocate for the context they have and the changes they need, the better outcome we're going to get. I'm not sure it's going to be perfect, but I think it's definitely better than those workers not having a voice in this conversation.
Yeah. I want to get into your work with Organize. And so, you know, because it strikes me that maybe part of it is to promote pro-worker outcomes, you know, in the workplace using technology. But I assume part of it is also to kind of oppose like sort of anti-worker outcomes and, you know, that, you know, when AI is like putting people maybe out of jobs or putting people, you know, into almost a straitjacket in terms of being maximum productivity and stuff like that, no matter what. So, yeah, just curious to hear how Organize like leverages technology to, you know, empower workers and drive change in working conditions.
Yeah, I wonder if it's best to talk through an example. So like, because the classic example that I think everyone probably listening to this podcast knows is like Amazon are really geared towards like absolutely maximizing productivity. to the point that they burn through 150%. They have 150% churn of
Wow. their workers. Wait, what does that even mean? Explain to me 150%, because I hear 100%. I'm like, all right, your entire workforce is churning over. But like, yeah, explain that to me.
It's basically within a year, more than their entire workforce is churning over.
Wow.
That's how many workers they're burning through.
Okay.
And the challenge they have, particularly in the UK, and I think we'll see this play out in the US, is they're running out of workers to work for them. Because they're burning through them, and it's such a heinous place to work, allegedly. And I think we see that on our platform, but we have some really positive examples of how workers have basically used our platform to map what's happening inside Amazon, not just in their warehouse, but see how that stacks across distribution centers, other warehouses, and then use that data to advocate for changes in how shifts are allocated or how work is allocated. So like how the rate is set is a big challenge for workers at the moment. And so they're currently running a campaign on our site to map how the parcel, this is like testing my knowledge here.
Yeah.
I'm not expert in this sort of stuff, but it's basically about like the shape and the size of the parcels that they're packing. And that can be really affected. But at the moment, one parcel is counted as one. So if you have a giant parcel, it can really slow down your rate. You get fired, you lose your job. And obviously that's data that Amazon either don't know about or aren't aggregating across their sites. And the workers can use our site to aggregate that and add it. Huh. Send it back to management. But I think that's a really good example.
That seems like a flaw in Amazon's model there, though, where like they're like counting a large package the same in terms of productivity, sort of movement standpoint, as a small package. So like, is your data like enriching them, or like, or do you find that like, is that helping Amazon like have a better productivity measure, or is it mostly just for the workers?
So I think it's the beauty of the organized platform is all driven by the workers. So what I love is like things are started and run on there that I fundamentally do not understand. Mm-hmm. I'm not in those jobs. And I think so for those workers, like the outcome they're interested in is like, how do they make their jobs better? For them, it's about like they get written up if they don't hit their targets. So they want to avoid getting written up. But I think the outcome for Amazon is that actually it'll probably make them more efficient because they'll be able to optimize better. So it's kind of a net win-win.
Is there an element of the work that you do that could potentially, you know, help some of these companies by not like reducing their churn from 150% to maybe something lower than that? Like, do you sort of try to play nice with the companies in question here to some extent? Just curious about that.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think the companies who engage with the workers on our platform have the best outcomes.
Mm.
And we see that time and time again.
Okay.
It's a bit scary because we're doing something new. Like often, you know, the companies we're targeting haven't had their workers at the bottom level take action and organize together, and they can get a bit spooked by that. But the ones who engage definitely get the best outcomes.
How do you validate that? How do you, like, you make a claim like that companies, you know, that are on your platform have the best outcomes? Like, what are the proof points there?
Well, the workers themselves define what they count as a win. So for some of them, it might be getting the change they want, or some of them, it might just be getting heard. And it might be that there's a compromise in what they want. So for example, we had like a bunch of supermarket workers who wanted radios, or they actually wanted to, I think it was an extra staff member on the floor, and they compromised on getting radios so they could talk to each other when they were in different parts of the store. And that's an example where like, it just is something I don't understand. The workers are really happy with that outcome though.
And is there like sort of a transitive property? Like, are you seeing that in terms of the business outcomes for these companies? Like, are they, you know, more efficient, more profitable, longer lasting? Like, are you making that connection, or is it kind of stop at the level of worker sentiment?
To be honest, we don't do that analysis yet. I think as we get bigger across different countries, it'd be really cool to start doing some of that research piece. But at the moment, we're just focused on the outcomes for workers.
Yeah, no, that's fair. And what talking about like trade unions, like how do you collaborate with them, you know, in the context of the work that you do?
Yeah, so trade union members are on our platform. So, you know, workers can either be in a union or not. We see about 30% of our membership is probably also in a trade union, but the bulk aren't, which kind of reflects the wider working population, right? And so we have worked with some unions in terms of partnerships to see like, okay, if our workers are driving for this thing, this is something the union's also pushing for, let's link them up. But also we see some fascinating uses where grassroots trade union members use organized to lobby their own union to change their position on stuff, which I wasn't expecting when we set it up, but it's quite fun to watch.
That's really interesting. Okay. So that's to say that you workers who use your platform are lobbying their own union to kind of get sort of better. Yeah, that's fascinating. Okay.
Or to be more ambitious, that's one of the use cases as well. Established unions, they're in with management, they're in discussions, they have their patterns. And sometimes actually it can be really useful for workers to drive that to be a bit more ambitious.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, because like sometimes it's like union leaders and, you know, like sort of bosses at companies, like they can get into kind of like management speak and kind of get removed from the actual work experience on the ground. So it sounds like you're getting at that a little bit and preventing that from disenfranchising the workers who aren't at the table, I guess.
Yeah, which is definitely not something we were thinking about when we set it up, but it's quite a cool use case to see.
Right. Do you get any resistance from union, trade union leadership on that, who kind of want to be negotiating at this sort of white collar level and forgetting about the blue collar folks?
I think when we started in the UK, there was definitely quite a bit of resistance to us, I think, because we were an unknown entity. But I think as we've gone on and we've built, you know, we've shown that there's a huge demand for this, that actually unions have been like, it's better to work with us than to fight it.
And how do you think about just sort of, not all unions are created equal. So like, are there any types of unions you don't work with? Or I know, like, obviously in the States, like police unions are quite controversial given recent events. So like, just curious about how you navigate that.
Yeah, so it's really worth saying, like, our business model is all B2C. So we're direct with the worker. So when we say work with them, there's no sort of paid or formal relationship. So we're quite agnostic, as long as the workers themselves, they're the ones who decide what we do and drive what happens on the platform. So if they want to work with their union, I think we're pretty open to it. But there's no sort of head office policy where we're deciding or picking and choosing on the types of unions. I think the types of unions that excite me the most are the kind of grassroots new ones. So things like the Amazon Workers Union, the Starbucks United Gang, the Trader Joe's United. They're doing really cool and radical stuff. That's very grassroots led. And I think that's what I'm most excited about seeing, like, kind of blossom on the platform alongside, rather than the more traditional and established stuff.
Yeah. And what's it like, kind of almost a different version of the first question, but like, what's your sense of what needs to change about like worker organizing? Obviously, if you can chuck in the tech component, we're interested in that. But like, yeah, what needs to shift, you know, for worker organizing to be, you know, more relevant, more effective, more powerful in this day and age, would you say?
Yeah, so I think the biggest shift, and I kind of mentioned it earlier, is like this relationship of one person having one job. Like, I just don't think that's how many workers experience the world of work anymore. So like, rather than you having a union job and that being it, actually you might have multiple jobs, and having power within each of those is really important. So I think that's probably the biggest shift that needs to happen, and like thinking away from regional structures and into actually, you know, if you're organizing Amazon, for example, at the moment, a lot of the grassroots stuff is happening like distribution center by distribution center, but Amazon's policy is set at head office. So actually we need to be working that across the entire workforce rather than in certain regions, because the way decisions are made, it's not like it used to be 30, 40 years ago, where it was like, this warehouse is structured like this, this one's different. It's like, fundamentally, there's someone at head office probably crunching a big data set, making those decisions.
So it is more centralized these days, you're saying?
A lot more centralized. So, and I think that that's the value of having a very distributed and decentralized network to counter that.
Interesting. Yeah, because it strikes me that, like, you know, well, and I don't know how this applies, but sort of that the decentralization of all these like little contract negotiations, like all over, can in many ways like allow, you know, the companies to kind of divide and conquer, as it were. So do you see that as a positive thing, that like a lot of these negotiations are maybe being more centralized, or is it negative because they're maybe holding more power at the central office level, you know, across all these different regions or, you know, factories and, you know, things like that?
Yeah. So I think like, if as long as the decentralized kind of stuff then comes back together, I think that's where it becomes really powerful. So it's like, you need to build power at the sort of decentralized nodes, but together that's where the real power comes in.
Yeah, it's interesting.
And being able to act in solidarity.
I used to work in education, and I remember traveling to Finland and, like, you know, learning about their education system, which is like, you know, one of the most well-regarded ones in the world, and seeing how they negotiate at the national level for teachers, you know, rights, and how that seems very effective. Their teachers are really well taken care of and well trained, and thinking that the way we do it in the U.S. is so, you know, balkanized and you know, diffuse, and it allows for some problematic things to make it into, you know, contracts and things like that in some cases. But it really fractures, I think, the movement, you know, the organized work movement. So I was always fascinated by that experience.
A kind of an extreme version of that is when you look at the gig economy, if you look at like Uber drivers, for example, who have like that's the most, you know, decentralized, like, you know, you're negotiating on your own, basically. So being able to aggregate Uber drivers or whoever they might be, DoorDash gang, then being able to aggregate and then negotiate, like, that's, I think, where it becomes quite exciting. Imagine if you can get like a national contract for all couriers. I think they've done this in some states, like New York has a levy on some of these things.
Right.
But I think that's where, yeah, making it as easy as possible to negotiate.
And does any of your work entail that in terms of, like, you know, any advocacy, or is it more just at the worker level? Like, are you sort of simultaneously pushing for, you know, policy changes or, you know, sort of broader shifts that might affect the workers you're working with on the ground floor?
Yeah, so we do some national stuff, mm-hmm. But primarily it's all driven by the workers. So if you think of a trade union as somewhere that represents workers, we're a set of tools to give workers the tools to represent themselves. So it's quite different in that sense.
What's maybe one of the, just to dig into the tools, like one of the coolest ways, and I think you kind of mentioned the workers talking to their unions, but what are some of the other cool sort of ways that you've seen workers leverage your platform and maybe surprising or interesting ways?
Yeah, so I think some of my favorite examples are the sexual harassment campaigns we see on the site. So one of our biggest campaigns that made the press was a bunch of workers who worked at Ted Baker, which is a fashion chain, and two of them actually in the same week reported on our platform that they've been sexually harassed by the CEO. And it was like, oh, two by the CEO, that seems quite high.
Wow.
So one of them ran a survey to be like, has anyone else seen anything that made them feel uncomfortable? Overnight, 25 other workers reported basically very similar things from the CEO. And the fascinating thing is that the workers didn't want this to go public, so they kept it. That's one of the options on organisers. You can just keep this internal. They took it to the company, and the company's response was, oh, this is a phishing scam. Don't fill it out. They're trying to get your data.
Yeah.
Which to the worker, imagine, you know, you finally got the courage to report this harassment, and then you're told, oh, it's a scam. Ignore it. Mm-hmm. So then they basically spread it across the whole company, and they had 100 workers join their campaign sharing details of either things they'd witnessed or things they'd experienced. They took it to the board, but the board were all very cozy with this sole founder CEO, mm-hmm. Ted Baker. They'd been his friends for years. The board hadn't changed. There was very weak governance at the company. Mm-hmm. So the workers let it sit with the board for a month. They got no response. So they decided to take it to the press. They ran a petition. It went in the press. On the day it landed in the press, they wiped £150 million off the company's share price. And within 3 days, the CEO was like on leave. And within 3 months, he was fired because they investigated the claims and obviously found a lot of them to be very true. And that for me was just such a good example of one worker on their own reporting that would probably have had a payoff and been, you know, got rid of or just told, you know, their biggest fear, because this guy is, you know, Ted Baker is a big known brand. They were like, is my career in fashion? Fashion's quite a difficult industry to get into as well. They were worried that, you know, is it going to ruin my career? And the beauty of the tool meant that it was completely anonymous. So we know who people are, but to Ted Baker, they didn't. So you had that safety to speak out on something that you'd sat on for years. And we had people join the campaign who worked with the guy like 20 years ago and sat with this harassment and then finally got the courage to speak out. So I think those sort of the ability to have the safety in numbers, we call them like tipping points. So it's like you can basically test the water. It doesn't go anywhere public until you've basically sense checked with other people. Mm-hmm. Is this something you're experiencing? Is this something I should do something about? And that's one of the features I'm most proud of the platform.
That's really interesting. And how do you sort of toe the line? Like, obviously, once you get into, you know, sexual harassment territory, you're obviously, you know, jumping into like legal terrain. And obviously there's like issues of, you know, defamation, libel, like all that stuff. So like, how do you toe the line between, you know, this becoming just kind of like a, you know, a board where people, you know, chuck complaints, like maybe another version of Glassdoor or something like that. And like, how do you verify, you know, like the sort of veracity of the charges and like sort of straddle that line between like, is this a legal action or is this, you know, sort of workers establishing their rights and you know, having the right to say, hey, I experienced this in the workplace. This is not okay. You know, let's have someone do something about it, whether it's the board or the courts or whomever.
Yeah. So for us, we call it like crowd moderation. Mm. So we've had another example of like racism at the post office is one of our recent ones. Someone reports that that's something that they're experiencing, but one person on their own is not going to be something we run a petition on or kind of take. So it's like, has anyone else experienced this? And all of a sudden, everyone in the network is verified. So if you get 10, 20 people saying, hey, that happened to me too, all of a sudden it's like, okay, this isn't just one individual with one bad manager. Mm-hmm. This is a systemic problem at the company. And so that's the kind of, it's basically like the crowd having a say.
Yeah. So you need more than one person to kind of, you know, begin to corroborate or substantiate an initial complaint and then it sort of picks up steam from there, it sounds like.
Yeah, absolutely. And it might not be that they've experienced it, but it might be that they've witnessed it.
Yeah. We're obviously a you know, growth strategy agency and we, you know, like to delve into, you know, all types of different digital marketing strategies and tech that's out there. So just very curious, like you've obviously grown organized. You started in the UK, you said, right? And then branched over to the US. Did that cause your move? Like you moved over to the US to kind of open up the branch over there? Is that how that worked?
Yeah, so we saw quite a lot of organic growth over here. And so basically it was like the energy's over here. And also it's a much bigger market for us. So we have 5% of the UK workforce. If we have 5% of the US workforce, then we're at 15 million members. all of a sudden we're starting to make a lot of traction. And it's corporate seat of power, so that's the other reason we're over here. So when we've got, you know, Amazon workers taking action in the UK, some of those decisions are still getting made at corporate head office in the US, so we wanted to have a presence here as well.
Yeah.
That was part of the reason driving our expansion.
How did you feel about that personally? We've switched places here, like obviously I've made the opposite, but like, how did you feel about that personally, making the leap to the US yourself as a founder?
I actually really enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. I was a bit hesitant because I love London.
Yeah.
And I mean, you love London, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Very silly. But I was really lucky. My partner came with me, which has been a big support. And I came over with our first ever employee basically also wanted to come. So it's like the gang is here.
That's awesome. Yeah, curious, back to my original question, like sort of what, like digital marketing, you mentioned like lots of organic growth. So that's exciting. We love to hear that as a content marketing agency, for example. What strategies did you employ to sort of like access that growth? How do you continue to plan on scaling and particularly as you roll out across the rest of the US?
Great question. So for us, petitions are our main growth tool. So we see when somebody creates a petition, they bring in three people who bring in three people, you know, it's the classic network effect. But the challenge for us is like, how do you find those first organizers, we call them, they're sort of our action creators, to get the ball rolling. So we're focusing the US on the top 10 employers. So that's people like Target, Walmart, those big kind of known brands. And we started with a few like national level petitions. So there's one around like raising the federal minimum wage. Anyone who joins that gives us their workplace, their industry, and then they're filtered down. And then from there, we're basically every week, you know, workers are creating stuff in Walmart and Target, and that's bringing more and more people in, and that's how it snowballs. So focus on those big 10 employers first. But pockets of other workers are starting to grow as well. We had 700 disc golf employees join.
Huh? What's disc golf?
Literally had never heard of it as a sport. Yeah. It's like frisbee golf, basically. It has a league. And has 700 of them who are now on a platform on our platform.
Wow.
But that's an example where, you know, they do that at the weekend. It's technically professional because there are prizes, but they all have other jobs as well. And so each one of them who's joining is then joining their subsequent networks or creating the network for their workplace. And that's how we grow.
And you've played on both sides of the pond. So just curious, or this always fascinates us, but like the differences between the growth strategies you've used in the US versus the UK. Like, I think when I moved over here, I, you know, assumed that much more was in common than it's truly turned out to be in terms of audiences and sort of tone of voice and all that stuff. So yeah, just curious what you've seen there.
My brutal analysis is that the stereotypes are true. In our user engagement, our US users are so much chattier.
Yeah.
They love to comment. They love to dive into the comments like really early from when they join the platform, in a way that the UK, it takes them a while to warm up and trust that what they say is going to be confident, because obviously you're disclosing big and important stuff. And in the UK, the users we see, like, it takes them a while to gain that trust and then to start sharing and commenting. Whereas in the US, they're straight in. There's no holding back. They're jumping in, they're sharing all sorts of stuff. And that's the biggest difference we see, which is good for us because like commenting is kind of the biggest driver of subscriptions.
So commenting on the platform, you're saying drives subscriptions? Or?
Yeah, that's one of the biggest indicators of someone's propensity to be a subscriber.
Got it. That's a cool metric. I like that. That's interesting. Yeah, we're an open chatty bunch, us Yanks. So yeah, that's interesting. Like, that's blown us away. Like, the number of touches, put it that way, that you know, we need to make with like potential client over here, for example, it's just blown us away. Like, there's so much more work you need to do, and you need to come at it and know five different people that person knows that they refer. It's just like really, really, it's tough work. So kudos to the Brits for being, you know, stiff upper lip, as it were. But any advice for other folks like launching, you know, social enterprises in terms of, you know, how they're looking to scale? Obviously, you've had a lot of success. So like, what are your sort of learnings looking back there?
Yeah, I think, you guys are a great agency as well, right? My main tip was like, test everything. When we had 2,000 members, we still had like the discipline of testing absolutely every piece of content, which felt ridiculous when you're not getting statistical significance with 2,000 people on your email list. But we did it, and then that rigor was built into when we're scaling up. That plays huge dividends. Like, you know, if you're testing and getting a 20% improvement on everything, that compounds. And I think that's a big driver of why we've been so successful with our growth.
In terms of driving your growth, like, how have you all managed it? Do you have like an internal team that does all that? Do you work with freelancers? Do you work with agencies? Like, curious how you put together the team that's driven the growth that you've seen.
Yeah, so it's all in-house. Mm-hmm. And there's only 8 of us. We're pretty small.
Oh, wow.
But we send out content every day. From the platform, like finding the best stuff. And that's basically the thing that drives the repeat engagement and drives the growth.
That's great to hear that you use content, because the one thing we always talk about is like, you know, you have your main product, which is like the thing you do for your clients. And then content is kind of your second product that drives people into your main product. And it sounds like you're doing just that. So good on you. That's amazing.
We get the benefit that the users create the content.
Yeah.
So we've got a free pipeline of very juicy stuff.
Yeah, the UGC, you know, user-generated content, that's the way to go. That always gets folks most excited. Well, wanted to sort of close here, just getting to know you a bit more and understanding a bit about your founder story. You told us a bit about how, you know, why you've made the jump to the US and you know, that's related to the growth of Organize. But wanted to understand what motivated you to create this platform and you know, empower workers to advocate for change in their workplaces. What are you bringing personally to the movement?
Yeah, totally. The thing to know is basically 30 years ago when my mom had me, she lost her job. She was the only female engineer at Marconi, and they just never had anyone try and take maternity leave before. So they didn't really know how to deal with it. And basically she ended up getting fired. I was like, I don't want anyone else to have to go through that. But I was like, you know, it's 30 years on, it's not happening really anymore. But it turns out today, 1 in 9 women still lose their jobs when they become pregnant. And the catalyst for me was, it was 2016, and one of my best friend's friends lost her job when she got pregnant. And I was like, absolutely, like, this is not happening. How do we get you your job back? So I had a chat to her. She worked at university. And I was like, why don't we run a crowdfunder to take the university to court? The key context here is that she didn't have the legal, they hadn't done anything illegal. They'd done it all by the book, but, you know, subtly got rid of her. And I was like, the threat of the crowdfunder. So we put it up. It had been up for 24 hours. We hadn't made any money on it. It had just been live. They were so worried about it that they gave her job back and full maternity benefits. And I was like, there's something in this idea of the power of the crowd, even though we weren't going to win that legal case, just the concept of a legal crowdfunder made them panic. And I was like, actually giving workers the tools to be like, hang on, even if you don't have the legal right, it's like morally, if something's wrong, like exposing that and making people hear about it is really powerful. And my background was in political tech. So I was used to building sort of online products to move large groups of people to create political change. And I was like, someone should do this for the workplace. And the things I thought it would need was the ability to be safe and anonymous if you needed it, and the ability to kind of map people by workplace. I spent a long time being like, someone should do this. And then yeah. I got rampantly impatient.
I'm just going to do it. Yeah. Well, first of all, I mean, we get the pleasure of, you know, interviewing loads of founders for, you know, like yourself for the podcast. And it almost always is like, hey, this experience happened to me or someone close to me or someone I care about. And that feeling of like, gosh, someone should do something about this. And then you do it. So like those strike us as like the best innovations in tech and the tech that can save us, as it were. So that's really, really great to hear. Curious if you have any advice for aspiring founders, like in the labor organization space, labor, you know, meets tech, like what are other like bits of the sector that you feel like need a tech solve or a tech related solve, would you argue?
I think there's like so much space in this vertical. Like there's very few people doing stuff. People don't really understand digital, I would say, the incumbents. Mm-hmm. So like just try and build anything that kind of, I think particularly helping people discover their collective power. So like those kind of, that's what I see organizers like the start of that funnel, touch points of the labor movement. So like really broadcasting that out, I think there's loads of space for that.
Yeah, that's fair. Talk to me about like monetization and financing for it. Like I imagine a lot of VCs aren't there being like, I'm just going to give you millions to like disrupt, you know, labor markets that are working quite well for them. A lot of these guys have come from finance, unfortunately. You know, they want to put downward pressure on the labor market, arguably, in a lot of ways. So like, yeah, how do folks get funded? How do they get the resources to do this kind of work?
Yeah, so I mean, we're VC backed, but they're impact VCs. Mm. So I would really recommend like looking at some impact funds, like people who care about a financial return, but also a social return. Mm. And then we have a bunch of angels, like really generous. A lot of them are Swedish, which kind of tallies with their love of the labor movement. But, you know, I see it as they sort of want capitalism and want to give back.
We love an announcement. Any like sort of, you know, new program or initiative coming across the line you want to shout out, or just any general sort of marketing piece you want to give a shout out for?
Obviously, we're growing across the US, so we'd love anyone to get in touch who's interested to help us with that journey, whether that's financial or like partnerships.
Yeah, and any like specific, it's a big country, any specific areas that the US you're looking to expand into that we can shout out?
Just anyone interested in the future of work, anyone thinking about these problems.
Cool. And where can folks find out more about your great work and Organize generally on the interwebs?
Yep, so our URL is organize.network.
Got it. Cool. Well, this has been another episode of Tech Can Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. We had the great pleasure of talking with Nat Wally, the co-founder and CEO of Organize. Thanks so much for jumping on the pod today.
Thanks, Boo.
For all of our listeners out there, please, as always, smash the subscribe button. Give us 5 stars, please, so we can get more fantastic guests like Nat on the pod. Talk more about tech empowerment for workers and all the good stuff happening out there in the world of tech. Thanks so much, Nat.